Marco Werman here. I want to take a moment to personally thank everyone who has donated to the World's Fall Fundraiser. That means thanking you for being with the world. If you haven't given yet, we can certainly still use your support. A generous donor has set a challenge match for us. When we raise $67,000 by December 31st, each donation will be matched one for one. In other words, if you give $100, the world will receive $200. This will have a huge impact on the stories we're able to bring you in 2024. Also, we have a special thank you for anyone who makes a one-time gift of $100 or creates a recurring donation of $10 a month. We'll send you a music playlist of some of our favorite tunes, specially curated by our team here at The World. So what do you say? Make a donation today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much. When the ceasefire ends in Gaza, Israel says its plans are still the same: destroy Hamas militarily. One expert tells us that won't end this conflict.
Until we get to a point where we can start talking about diplomatic resolution, negotiations toward an end of occupation, an end of conflict, we're going to constantly see this kind of cyclical violence.
I'm Marco Werman. The opposition in Myanmar is gaining ground against the military junta. And in Poland, a border wall is raising concerns, and not just about migration.
We should also think how to monitor these environmental costs of this construction.
Also on the show today, fighting a proud tradition, Uber is trying to woo the London drivers of their famous black cabs. It's going to be a tough sell.
As far as we're concerned, it's not a partnership that we want to be part of.
All those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. The temporary truce in the fighting in Gaza between Hamas and Israel held for another day, but there are big questions about what comes next and whether this war is even close to being over. Dozens of Israeli hostages are still being held by Hamas and other militant groups. They could be exchanged for more Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. U.S. officials are part of the mediation effort to extend the ceasefire. Today, though, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was clear about Israel's military goals in Gaza. Netanyahu said returning the hostages and eliminating Hamas so that Gaza will no longer be a threat to Israel, those goals remain unchanged. To talk about that objective of eliminating Hamas, we turn to Zaha Hassan. She's a human rights lawyer and a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Zaha, in 2 months of war, as far as you can tell, how much damage do you think the IDF has done so far to Hamas as a military force in the Gaza Strip?
It doesn't look like there has been much damage to Hamas at this point. It is possible to degrade or eradicate the military operations of Hamas in Gaza. The question is that going to eliminate Hamas as a movement, Hamas as an idea, or the idea of armed resistance against Israel? And I don't think that this type of operation that we've been seeing for over 50 days now carried out in Gaza, where we're seeing all this civilian death and destruction, is going to do anything but increase the ranks of organizations that are bent on armed resistance against Israel. We know this from past campaigns in Gaza between Israel and Hamas, and we know this because of counterinsurgency efforts the U.S. has been involved with in other parts of the world.
Yes. So when Prime Minister Netanyahu says that this war isn't over, that Hamas must be, quote, eradicated, of those various possibilities you just listed, armed resistance, the idea of Hamas, the philosophy, which of those do you think Netanyahu actually means?
I think he believes that he can eliminate Hamas completely, and I don't think that's possible. And so you can eliminate Hamas, you know, as a military, but you'll find other organizations coming together to resist occupation. You know, violence is a natural outcrop of violence. And so until we get to a point where we can start talking about a diplomatic resolution, negotiations toward end of occupation and end of conflict, we're going to constantly see this kind of cyclical violence.
Zaha, if it's not realistic to eradicate Hamas, what should Israel be doing with this group that's sitting right next door and it's made it clear that it seeks nothing less than the destruction of Israel?
Well, I think the ceasefire that we've been witnessing is an important start to a conversation that needs to be had. Hamas isn't going anywhere as an idea. Hamas isn't going anywhere as a movement. The Palestinian Authority and PLO are interlocutors as well that need to be sat at the table with Israel. And we need to have much more international engagement to put pressure on the parties to get to a diplomatic resolution. There is no military answer to what ails Israelis and Palestinians. It has to come at the negotiating table, and it has to come with a recognition that international law matters. What international law says about occupied peoples and occupied territories need to rule the day. It's an objective arbiter of disputes, and that's the way we get to the kind of peace and quiet that I think Israelis and Palestinians need right now.
What about the Palestinian responsibility for allowing Hamas to maintain control?
The Palestinians are responsible for that failure of holding elections so that there could be a rejuvenation of Palestinian leadership so that there could be a unified Palestinian leadership over the people in both the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank. And so that they have to take responsibility for. But, you know, it was after the elections in 2006 that, you know, Hamas won and that the world boycotted the Palestinian Authority, so long as it included Hamas. And so that was sort of the genesis of the political fragmentation of the Palestinian body politic. And so that's what we were left with. And so I think moving forward, the international community is going to have to consider whether it can countenance a relationship with a Palestinian elected leadership that includes organizations like Hamas, and whether that relationship could be a moderating force on organizations like Hamas that would be part of a Palestinian elected leadership.
Do you think that's realistic to kind of make Hamas more moderate?
Well, we haven't tried it. We've tried the other way of doing it, which is to boycott and to then encourage this kind of fragmentation between the West Bank and Gaza. And that hasn't gone well. We've tried that now for 16 years, and all we've seen is death and destruction and violence, both inside of Gaza as a result of the bombardments, and now in October 7th, we've seen what Hamas can do outside of Gaza and inside Israel, attacking Israeli civilians. So I think it behooves us now to try something different.
Zaha, finally, the Biden administration has urged Israel not to give in to vengeance, saying that it matters how Israel conducts this war. President Biden has alluded to American military mistakes following 9/11. Do you think that message is sinking in with the Israeli leadership?
I don't think so, honestly, because what we're hearing from the Israeli side is that, you know, they're going to, you know, they have no intention of, you know, once the hostages are released, they have no intention of maintaining a ceasefire, that they want to continue into the southern part of Gaza and continue what they started in the north. And what we know now, you know, in their operations in the north is that, you know, that's resulted in a big, extremely high civilian casualty. It's cost so much in terms of the destruction that has been wrought on Gaza. So I hope that Israel will heed the president's words of caution. But so far, what we understand from the Israeli prime minister is that he plans to continue into the south.
Zaha Hassan is a human rights lawyer and a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and speaking with us today about the feasibility of Israel's goal of eliminating Hamas. Zaha, thank you very much for helping us understand this better.
Thanks for having me.
The leaders of Myanmar's military junta now admit that large parts of the country could permanently break free from their control. This month, the junta has steadily lost territory to an armed resistance movement made up of different ethnic groups. The resistance formed nearly 3 years ago after the military seized power from a democratically elected government. The World's Patrick Wynn reports on the swift and unprecedented opposition victories against Myanmar's army.
Myanmar's military is known as one of the fiercest in Asia. The UN calls their tactics brutal, even genocidal. But they don't look as tough as they used to. Drop your guns and come out. That's a resistance commander shouting at junta troops who are cowering behind a cement wall. His comrades record the moment on their phones. Now, they could easily finish off the enemy troops. Instead, the resistance commander says to his fighters, "Under the rules of war, we will not hurt them if they surrender. Right?" he asks.
No one below that, where are
we?
Right, they say, and give their enemies water and medical aid. This scene from 2 weeks ago, gone viral in Myanmar, took place in Loy Kao, one of the country's regional capitals. And that's a big deal. In Myanmar, every region has a capital serving as a bastion of military control. This one appears to be falling to the resistance. Soon, others may too. Resistance forces bearing down on Lashio, an even bigger military stronghold. Fighter jets launch from this city to dominate the skies near the border with China. But the resistance has, in its own words, liberated much of the area. Dozens of villages, hundreds of rural army bases, even roads leading to China. They're conduits for billions of dollars in trade. For the junta, losing a city like Lashio would be catastrophic. So it's gearing up for urban warfare.
Inside Lashio, there's a lot of soldiers. Every block, every place, everywhere.
That's a resident of Lashio. He asks that I not reveal his name to avoid retribution from any side. He says families in Lashio are scrounging up enough rice and water to last a month inside their homes. He's now trying to choose a good hiding place for his kids in case war comes to his street.
We are so scared. We are civilian, you know. We are not safe.
Many people are astonished that the resistance is now taking over cities. At the outset of this movement, fighters were desperate. Young people, sick of marching against the junta and getting shot at, were just learning how to shoot back. Some picked up their grandfather's old hunting rifles to snipe at junta platoons. They've since evolved into a force with artillery, explosives, and solid tactics.
The resistance really gained quite a bit of momentum, and the military is, at this point, losing.
Scott Marciel is a former U.S. ambassador to Myanmar and author of Imperfect Partners, a book about American policy in Southeast Asia. Myanmar is wedged between China and India. It is strategically vital. But Marciel says Washington, D.C. doesn't seem to get how fast events are moving. This isn't some plucky little resistance anymore, something everyone can ignore while they focus on Ukraine or Gaza.
I don't know what number it is on the list of priorities, but it's not in the top three or four. Even before Gaza, you weren't seeing the investment of time and resources and energy in Myanmar that I think would be appropriate.
The resistance has a government called the National Unity Government, or NUG. It's got ministers of finance, foreign affairs, health, and so on. They're ready to lead a democratic Myanmar if their side wins. And they do get some praise from Washington. But Congress still hasn't recognized them as the sole rightful government of Myanmar.
If the U.S. recognized the NUG, the assumption would be that the junta would then end diplomatic relations and force us to close our embassy.
Former Ambassador Marciel also says some worry this revolutionary government could not hold the country together. The resistance is actually a constellation of many armed factions, some based in the mountains, others by the coast. They all dream of toppling the junta, but don't answer to one leader. Still, they are the country's best hope, Marciel says. The U.S. should support it and resist the urge to pit the revolutionaries against China. Marciel suggests that'll just bring more chaos to Myanmar.
Any government that emerges would want to and need to have good relations with China. And that should not be an issue for the United States.
The resistance has a hard fight ahead. Until there is a resolution to the struggle, civilians, such as the man I spoke to in Lashio, will continue to live in survival mode.
Our children, they're not safe. We cannot guarantee for tomorrow.
This is Patrick Nguyen reporting for The World.
Most people think they know all they need to know about Christian rock.
Whether you think it's cheesy propaganda pretending to be cool,
or if you think it's the only pop music unsullied by worldly vices,
you'll find something to love on Rock That Doesn't Roll.
I'm Leah Payne, author of A History of Contemporary Christian Music.
And I'm Andrew Gill, a public radio producer who grew up on Christian rock.
On Rock That Doesn't Roll, we're talking with people who loved Christian rock in its peak era and learning how it affected them as they grew up.
Listen to Rock That Doesn't Roll wherever you get your podcasts.
The news can be disorienting, and it can be really hard to remember how we got here. That's why we started the Throughline podcast. Every week, we take you on a cinematic trip into the past to better understand the present. Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The temporary truce in Gaza has been accompanied by relative calm along Israel's northern border with Lebanon. On Saturday, an Israeli shell hit a UN peacekeeping patrol in the area. That patrol was part of UNIFIL, or the UN Interim Force in Lebanon. It's been operating there since 1978. As tensions flare yet again on the so-called Blue Line that divides Israel and Lebanon, reporter Rebecca Collard visited UNIFIL's base near the border.
The walls of spokesperson Andrea Tanetti's office reflect the long history of UN peacekeepers in South Lebanon. There's a photo of the aftermath of a blast in the coastal city of Tyr during Lebanon's civil war, and a more recent, more peaceful one of Tyr's fishermen going out to sea. There is also a map of South Lebanon showing the positions of the UN forces over 10,000 personnel. Their mandate, says Tanetti,
ensure that stability is maintained in the south. And until last month, the south of Lebanon had witnessed one of its longest periods of stability since 2006.
But that stability has now been broken by daily exchanges of fire across the border. And our interview is interrupted by that fire also.
Nakura base to level 3. We need to
go downstairs. Okay. We do the rest of the interview inside the bunker. UNIFIL was created in 1978 by a UN Security Council resolution after Israel invaded Lebanon. The original mandate was to confirm the withdrawal of Israeli forces, restore international peace and security, and assist the Lebanese government in returning its authority to South Lebanon. A tall order. Just 4 years after the peacekeepers arrived, Israel invaded Lebanon again to root out Palestinian militants that had been using South Lebanon to launch attacks against Israel. Attacks UNIFIL couldn't stop either. Then in 2000, Israel finally withdrew from South Lebanon. But that was credited to Hezbollah's resistance, not the UN forces. 6 years after that, violence exploded again. Israel and Hezbollah fought a month-long war that left more than 1,000 Lebanese and more than 150 Israelis dead. The end of the 2006 war ushered in a new mandate for UNIFIL. Here's how it's described in a documentary created by the peacekeeping force.
With the cessation of hostilities brokered by the United Nations, thousands of international troops and weapons began to arrive in Lebanon. Resolution 1701 expanded UNIFIL from 2,000 to a maximum of 15,000 troops, so it could help the Lebanese army re-establish Lebanese authority.
Authority meant only the Lebanese army and UNIFIL should have weapons in that part of South Lebanon, between the Blue Line that marked Israel's withdrawal and the Litani River, some 20 miles north.
The Lebanese armed forces deployed their troops south of the Litani River into southern Lebanon for the first time in 30 years.
Then Secretary General Kofi Annan visited UNIFIL troops at the base in Nakura and said at the time that UNIFIL was often misunderstood.
They are criticized. They are never given credit for the wonderful things they have done, the sacrifices they have made. Since the UN came here, we've lost almost 300 people in the service of peace.
But why can't the peacekeepers keep the peace?
UNIFIL does not have a mandate to use force to find weapons, or it does not have a mandate to force its way.
Heiko Wimmen is with the International Crisis Group. He says that makes it hard for UNIFIL.
UNIFIL's mission is to prevent that the presence of arms, of unauthorized arms, south of the Litani, and the resistance, so-called resistance, is trying to do this.
In fact, some experts estimate Hezbollah, often called the resistance here in Lebanon, could now have an arsenal 10 times what they fired at Israel in the 2006 war.
Sometimes these UN patrols, they go around, they drive through villages that are pro-Hezbollah, and they sometimes have a hostile reception.
But remember, UNIFIL can't use force. They can only use their weapons to defend themselves.
So they need the Lebanese state to to do this with them, at least. If the Lebanese state doesn't do it because the Lebanese state can't face up to Hezbollah, then that's a very clear limit to performing this mandate.
So then there are the complicated politics of Lebanon. Hezbollah is part of the government, and many Lebanese support Hezbollah, or at least its resistance to Israel. Spokesperson Andrea Tanetti says confrontations are actually rare and often vague.
And at times we were told that these areas are private property, but it's very difficult to know what are the areas that are private properties, and no one is identifying themselves as, I don't know, Hezbollah or other kind of militia.
UNIFIL's mandate is renewed each year, and Lebanon has to agree. When it was renewed in September, just a month before the latest escalation, there was intense debate over UNIFIL continuing independent, unannounced patrols. Vimin says,
many leakages could happen from the army to Hezbollah so that they know where they go and that there are no surprises, and the already small chance that UNIFIL ever finds anything would become even smaller.
But many here welcome UNIFIL as a protector and a lifeline. In Tyre, 10 miles up the coast from the Nakoura base, Hussein Shaban gives me a tour of his pub, called the Blue Line, plastered with the many flags of the countries that send UNIFIL troops.
The flags, my customers bring it.
Really?
Come, you can have a look at the flag.
One of my Austrian friends.
And this is one Italian from my one of my good friends, his name Giuseppe.
Yeah. And then what else do we have?
This is United Nations and the Lebanese flag in the middle.
UNIFIL is also the second largest employer in South Lebanon and make what Shaban calls movement in the market, the sort of trickle-down effect of having thousands of UN staff spending money in Lebanon. They also provide health services, veterinary assistance to farms, and run things like yoga and language classes. Shaban named his pub the Blue Line after two UNIFIL troops he knew were killed in 2006.
They don't have to pay the price for because they are peacekeepers. They are not fighters.
And even though UNIFIL hasn't always been able to maintain the peace, he says without them...
And I was scared, and I will be so worried if they will move from here.
Back in the bunker, spokesperson Andrea Tanetti explains what they are able to do. Act as a mediator and a conduit of information between the forces on either side of the Blue Line. Every month or so, in an empty house in the no man's land, Israeli and Lebanese military officials meet under UNIFIL's supervision. They are trying to prevent dangerous misunderstandings that could lead to escalations no one intended.
It's already a success to think that two armies that are still at war, they have zero dialogue. There are no relations between the two countries.
The meetings are so sensitive that they bring neutral refreshments like Italian water. Lebanese aren't even supposed to talk to Israelis, so they address their questions and responses through the UNIFIL mediator.
And now, despite the conflict, still being able to have daily dialogue, and more than daily, like several times per day, with the force commander with both sides, has been somehow important to decrease tension, deconflict situations, although the conflict is still ongoing.
UNIFIL hasn't always been able to keep the peace here, but after 45 years, for many, it's difficult to imagine South Lebanon without them. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard on the UNIFIL base in Nakoura, South Lebanon.
I'm Julia Metzger-Traber.
And I'm Tasha Haverty. Join us in the depths of mothers' hearts, minds, and stories. As we crack open the definitions of motherhood, listen for the unspeakable, and make space for the questions that rise. What is a mother, we ask? And everything answers. Mother is a question. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You ever been there when an uncomfortable question about race comes up, but you don't know how to answer? That's where Code Switch lives. Each week, we're talking about race and how it intersects with every other aspect of your life, from politics and pop culture to history and food. Listen now to the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
A territorial dispute between Venezuela and Guyana goes way back. With a crucial referendum coming up soon, things are now boiling over.
In the years that I have been dealing directly with the Venezuelan issue, this is the most frightening period I have personally felt.
That and DIY music videos for a superstar ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Political limbo in Poland with an interim government led by the outgoing prime minister, whose party actually lost big in last month's hotly contested election. When the next government takes shape, Poland's border will be a key issue. The militarized border between Poland and Belarus carves through one of Europe's most ancient forests. For our next story, Lacey Healy and Katie Toth take us to that border in their reporting for the security podcast Things That Go Boom. It's where biologist Katarzyna Nowak shows Katie Toth how those woods are changing.
So this is a map of Puszcza Białowieska, of Białowieża primeval forest. And we are on Browska Road. And so we're about halfway to the border now, here at this junction of Browska and Koński Tryb.
This old-growth lowland forest is a rare and precious ecosystem. Rich underbrush feeds the little critters and saplings underfoot. More than 230 species of bird are out here. And at one point, while I'm out in the park, a deer just confidently darts across the trail. Katarzyna points out to me on the map where exactly we are.
You can see that this junction has been quite heavily used by vehicles. This was a sort of turning point for big vehicles last year, still is this year.
It was a big turning point because last year Poland finished its border fence just 15 minutes down the road through this ancient UNESCO heritage forest. The wall was built last year to keep out migrants traveling from the global south through Belarus. And now that tensions with Belarus are even worse, given the war in Ukraine, this fence is doing double duty. Soldiers from Poland have been sent to this region to keep an eye out for Wagner mercenaries. And Belarus has been accused of flying helicopters into Polish airspace.
I was curious to see if we're going to already sense some extra traffic on this road today. We have hardly seen anyone, so it's still quiet. I don't know if that's going to change or not, but I think it's worth continuing to monitor this forest road if such changes are going to take place.
The environmental impacts of the wall are something scientists like Katarzyna are still trying to put a number on today.
We started monitoring roadkill and roadside tree damage and other aspects of wall building and militarization in March of last year.
Katarzyna and her team are also looking beyond the wall itself. They're asking how even the road used to build a border fence and all of the new activity on that, trucks in and out full of people, raw materials, construction, how all that could further be hurting conservation and wildlife.
Okay, this is Lacey Healy here. Katarzyna wants to get up close to the creatures that so many of us miss, but she's also looking for a bigger picture of what's going on out here. That's why in an effort to understand the environmental impacts of this wall, she and other biologists are working on a network of 30 trail cameras that will take tens of thousands of pictures. And to hear the story that those pictures want to tell, the scientists have to find a way to go through all of that information. That's where AI comes in.
We obtain around 90% of accuracies. There are still some pictures we cannot be classified, but also by human observers. It's very difficult when there is a big distance between camera and individual, or they are partly on the other side of a tree and only part of a tail is seen. So you cannot be 100% sure that this is, I don't know, fox or raccoon dog or some other species.
That's Micha Michałowski.
I'm head of the Mammal Research Institute of the Polish Academy of Sciences, placed in Białowieża, eastern Poland.
He works on the statistical analysis of both Katarzyna's research on the road and her project studying the impacts of the wall itself. Micha explains that after a camera trapping session, biologists end up with tons of pictures that they need to make sense of. Machine learning algorithms, they cut the wheat from the chaff in days instead of months.
And then we can start some statistical modeling, explaining animal activity over time and across space. This is usually what we are most interested in.
Scientists like Micha look at the activity pattern of a given mammal species, like an elk or a wolf, and they see where they tend to go and what they tend to avoid. Then his team tries to understand how those patterns of behavior might be impacted by human presence in the forest.
And at the end, we are able to say, okay, in this habitat, wolf is much less active, for example, as compared to some other habitat. Or big road is also decreasing activity of this animal by 70% or something like this.
The barrier has now cost more than $400 million and slices Europe's oldest forest in half, which could mean more inbreeding of precious rare animals like bison and lynx. And just building it led to the introduction of invasive species in the area when one company dumped huge amounts of sand with foreign grass in it. As Katarzyna documents this all, she's also been asking a question. What if some of this impact on ecology could be mitigated? To answer that, she wants to figure out where any holes might be in the fence.
Areas which we assume do not have a barrier are here in the south, where there's the River Leshna. So it's very swampy here. And then here, near this reservoir, there's also some gaps, but we don't quite know where they are.
Katarzyna wants to know because she wants to know if the gaps could be matched up with the spots where animals naturally tend to cross between the Belarusian and Polish sides. It's part of a bigger challenge for her colleagues like Micha at the Mammal Research Institute.
If there is a need to build this kind of construction in the middle of the primeval forest, then we should also think how to monitor this environmental costs of this construction. What can we learn? How can we mitigate? Maybe we could somehow adjust this wall construction to the needs related with biodiversity conservation.
These aren't questions that Poland's right-wing leadership has been too keen to answer in recent years.
It's a pity that the government is deciding without informing anyone and without designing proper monitoring in advance.
We asked for information from Polish Border Guard about where gaps in the barrier are associated with these swampy habitats and where the gates are, but we have not had a response.
As we worked on this episode, Poland was racing toward a parliamentary election where both the ruling party and the head of the largest opposition were feverishly trying to outdo each other on xenophobic rhetoric.
The mur na granicy z Białorusią musimy zbudować.
The main opposition leader was saying that the wall wasn't aggressive enough at keeping people out, while the party that built the wall, even after it had been outed for a massive visas for bribe scheme, was touting its hardline defense of the Polish border.
That is this disease that takes place when this nationalism, autocratic, hateful system, environment is being created, entrenched for years. It starts changing this subtle concept of what's reasonable, yes? I'm Maciej Kislowski, and I am a professor at Central European University in Vienna.
In recent elections, the left and center opposition parties won a slim majority of seats over the ruling Law and Justice Party that's been in power for 8 years. And to Macha, the decision to build a wall, the fear-mongering about refugees from Africa and Asia, and the refusal to answer questions from scientists like Katarzyna, it's all part of the legacy of that party, which tried to push its government more and more away from democracy and toward nationalism.
Poland could have used it as an opportunity to show how different we are from Russia, from Belarus, and treat those people with respect, review their asylum claims, and of course, if there are no grounds for asylum, then deport them, of course, but do it in a humane way.
It's worth noting that Poland has become home to well over a million Ukrainian refugees since the beginning of the war. That leaves Macha with a question.
Why can't we accept 30,000 of those people bamboozled by the Belarusian dictator whom we all detest?
I used to work on different European borders, on the Greek-Turkish border, on Croatian-Bosnian border, or in Spain, in Melilla. I've seen a lot of situations on the Mediterranean Sea, and I can tell you that I've never seen so hungry and so thirsty people as on the border of my own country. It was really shocking.
Polish humanitarian worker Anna Albach is still haunted by what she saw at the peak of Poland's border crisis in 2021. 48 people have died trying to make the crossing, and hundreds are still missing. Polish border guards are still accused of illegally pushing people back into the neighboring country of Belarus, which for its part is accused of pushing them into Poland in the first place to stir Europe into a panic. Anna says that whoever takes government, she doesn't expect much to change for people trying to get to Europe any way that they can.
Maybe in other topics like, you know, abortion or LGBT rights will change into better in Poland. But when it comes to migration and when it comes especially to Polish-Belarusian border, I don't see much chance for it.
Macha disagrees. He doesn't think that this wall would come down, but he has a lot of confidence that while an opposition coalition might not create all of the conditions that NGOs would love to see for refugees, it would follow international law. But what he's also really hoping for is something that will take a lot more time. The opposition coalition is promising to bring back democratic checks and balances, the kind that could help people like Anna and Katarzyna keep leaders clear-eyed about the lesser-known impacts of their decisions.
The story of Poland was really about this country being a frontrunner in democratization in 1990s and early 2000s, and access to public information, the Polish FOIA of 2001, was a very extreme piece of this democratic, optimistic pro-Western period. Everything that wasn't classified was presumed to be accessible by any citizen, but it didn't impose any sanctions on public officials because it was unthinkable in 2001 that if the public official refuses to disclose and then the court tells them that this refusal is not warranted, it was unthinkable that the public official would not follow the court order.
Over the past 8 years, Macha says the ruling party used that loophole to become more and more tight-fisted with public information, while also giving itself more and more influence over the country's courts.
They don't even reject. They ignore claims for public information, or they say something which is highly misleading, edited, impossible to make sense of.
But once you open those doors again, and you start to give experts the facts to see things how they are, you can make all kinds of better choices. For example, the Białowieża Forest is more closely watched than it has ever been before. It's full of security cameras, alarms, border police, and troops. If some of that knowledge could be shared with scientists like Katarzyna, maybe they could help come up with better ways forward. But Dr. Katarzyna Nowak isn't waiting to be told what she's allowed to know.
We might walk the length of the Białowieża Forest ourselves to do some mapping and then estimate where least cost paths are for various species on the basis of colleagues' data from the Mammal Research Institute. And then we might be able to say something about the locations of the gaps in relation to those least cost paths.
In other words, if agencies like Polish Border Guard won't give her information about gaps in the Belarus-Poland border wall, she can just find them herself. One muddy step at a time.
That's Lacey Healy along with Katie Toth reporting from Poland for the security podcast, Things That Go Boom. If you've been to London, you've seen them. There are also indispensable features in movies set in London. I'm talking about the city's famous black taxicabs. They are iconic for their design, their jump seats, their efficient service, and for the knowledge. That is the grueling test that black cab drivers are required to pass to show that they know the name and location of every street in London and the quickest route to get there. So the news today that Uber is going to start to offer London black cab service on its app starting next year is getting a mixed response among drivers. Steve McNamara is one of them. He's also the head of the Licensed Taxi Drivers Association. What do you think, Steve? Uber and black cabs, is it a match made in heaven or something else?
It's just not happening, I'm afraid. We have the world's most iconic taxi service. We have the world's most regulated taxi service. We have the world's only 100% wheelchair accessible taxi service. We have the best trained taxi drivers in the world. 56% of our vehicles are now electric. We've got the greenest taxi fleet in the world. That's what we bring to the table. And so then we ask ourselves, what do Uber bring to the table? And as far as we're concerned, it's not a partnership that we want to be part of. We are extremely proud of our reputation. We are extremely proud of our safety record. And we don't want our brand sullied, so it won't be happening.
Well, under the plan and the announcement, I'm wondering, will black cab drivers like yourself be able to sign on with Uber as a kind of side gig and also keep your regular metered operation?
We had taxi hailing apps in London before Uber. We had one back in 2010, one of the first taxi hailing apps in the world. We are still on four platforms in London that do taxi hirings. We're on one called Free Now. There's one called Get. There's one called Taxi App. And there's a big one called Bolt. These are all big apps in Europe. And you can get a taxi, a black cab, on all of those apps. So, you know, being on an app is not new to us. It's not a surprise. It's something we already do. We're ready available on an app, but we won't be on Uber's app. Uber, in their press release, say that they've already signed up one driver, and I've seen him pop up on various news outlets today. And good, that's one out of 20,000, you know, 19,999 to go. And good luck with that.
If a driver signs up with Uber, as I understand it, they have the option of either accepting or rejecting a trip based on the price quoted. That seems that's a kind of flexibility that would make it worthwhile for a black cab driver to try it, no?
Well, firstly, the black taxi trade in London, the black cab trade in London has never, ever been as busy as we are at the moment. And there's two reasons for that. London is positively booming post-pandemic. But apart from that, we've massively increased our market share. We've seen a return of users of a much younger demographic that we thought we'd lost forever. People who can hail a cab off the street or get one on an app, and they can pay on a card or a phone. I mean, 90% of our business is now on cards. Nobody in London, well, 10% of people pay cash. And that has been universally successful for us. What we've also found is that these new electric cabs that we've got, the new black cab, and any current image of London, you'll see them. And they're green. And a lot of people like that. They like the green credentials. They like the fact that it's quiet, it's air conditioned, it's comfortable. Our customers like the fact that we know where we're going. I mean, you know, the English are obsessed with class. We always have been. And one of the classless elements of English society is a black cab. And because of that, we're doing very, very well. So do we need Uber? No, we don't. Thank you.
Steve McNamara is a veteran black cab driver in London, also the head of the Licensed Taxi Drivers Association, which represents more than half the black cab drivers in the city. Black cab drivers there are being courted now by Uber. Steve, thank you very much. Great to speak with you.
Thank you. Have a good evening. Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Two neighboring countries in South America, Venezuela and Guyana, have been arguing literally for centuries about where the border between their two countries should be. The dispute reignited recently after the Venezuelan government announced a national referendum on whether it should annex disputed territory near the border. That vote will take place on December 3rd, and as The World's TBS Isaiah reports, it is stirring up a lot of controversy.
Guyana is the only country in South America where English is the official language. That's a legacy of British colonizers who controlled this small region for more than a century. Another legacy of the British in Guyana turned out to be very problematic. A territorial dispute with Venezuela that has gone on for roughly 180 years. Guyana is about the size of the state of Utah, and the disputed area, which is called the Essequibo, represents two-thirds of the country, plus its rich in natural resources, including oil reserves recently discovered. So for people in Guyana, this is a very big deal.
In the years that I have been dealing directly with the Venezuelan issue, this is the most frightening period I have personally felt.
Ralph Ramkaran is a Guyanese politician.
And I think that the Guyanese people should be aware of the threats from Venezuela.
He's offended by Venezuela's upcoming referendum, which will ask citizens to vote on several questions regarding the border dispute. One of the questions is whether they would agree to annex Essequibo, giving Venezuelan citizenship to all of the residents there. About 100,000 people live in the Essequibo region. They mostly speak English and identify as Guyanese. Terry Caesar is a construction worker who lives in Essequibo and says he doesn't want it to become part of Venezuela.
I don't really feel as a Venezuelan because we've been growing up in Essequibo since I was a kid, and we only speak English here since we were growing up. So it'd be strange and weird to have another nationality which is not Guyanese.
Venezuela and Guyana have Spanish and British colonizers to thank for this long-standing dispute. Manuel Doniz, a Venezuelan historian who's written about the issue, explains.
cuando Venezuela se separa de la República de Colombia y comienza su vida republicana con Páez.
He says when Venezuela became its own country, there were plenty of maps drawn by the Spanish showing Essequibo as part of their territory. But British colonizers came up with other maps marking the border in a different place. And this led to a very long dispute. Both countries have tried to solve the issue diplomatically with no success. Now, Guyana has opened a case at the International Court of Justice. Samuel Hinz is the ambassador of Guyana to the United States.
Guyana has put its confidence in the court and the international rule of law. We intend to abide by the final decision of the court.
And it's likely that the ruling will be in favor of Guyana, says Sadio Garavini, a former Venezuelan ambassador to the country.
Es muy cuesta arriba anular un laudo.
For Venezuela, it will be difficult to find evidence and win the case, he says. And that is why the country is looking at other options, including the referendum. Luis Vicente León, a political analyst in Venezuela, says this referendum could also be a political strategy planned by President Nicolás Maduro.
Tratar de convertir a Maduro en un héroe de la defensa nacional.
León says the idea is to turn Maduro into a national hero who will defend Venezuelans in this dispute and unify them behind a common cause at a time of growing discontent with government and ahead of an electoral year, he says. To some Venezuelans, the referendum is just a distraction.
Yo me atrevo a decir que un gran porcentaje del pueblo venezolano no sabe.
Carlos Pérez, a young Venezuelan professional, says people in his country have a lot of other problems that are more urgent. But he agrees that Venezuela has the right to defend its territory. The referendum will be held on December 3rd, and it's not clear what the Venezuelan government will do after people have voted. For The World, I'm Tivisa Isaiah.
Even though those original years of MTV are long gone, music videos are still serious business. With big budgets, famous models, actors, and directors often get recruited to produce videos that look like short Hollywood movies. But British singer Ed Sheeran took a different approach when building a team to create music videos for his new album, Autumn Variations.
Hey guys, so Autumn Variations is coming. It's going to be my first album on my own record label, and I want to get creative with the fans. So basically, if you know anyone that makes music videos, please comment and tag them below. It can be from any country, anywhere. You don't have to be a professional music video person. You can just be a creative, whatever, art, anything.
Sheeran posted that on Instagram in September. He planned to select people from 14 countries to make 14 music videos. His global fan base got to work, and reportedly 4,000 entries poured in from more than 75 countries. The winners started getting announced last week.
Is this just getting older? I can't get away from this rain. I'm starting to think that it's me, and I want to just create things, but the longer it takes...
Sheeran's team chose a music video from Brazil for his song, That's On Me. It was created by Beatriz Santa Maria Pina, a writer and director. She depicted an older man trying to figure out who he is after a series of major life changes. There were also winners from Japan, Australia, and France.
But now until then, I'm holding out for spring.
The French music video is for the song Spring. It follows a vinyl record of Sheeran's album rolling around Paris, getting damaged on the metro and banged up on city streets, but moving on anyway. The director, Clara Griot, says it's a metaphor for pushing through when life gets tough. From India comes the music video for Ed Sheeran's song, Head Then Heels.
How beautiful he bled, crashing in head and heels.
This one is animated and the only one made with AI. Anshul Mittal and Kanika Gupta created it and posted about the project on social media.
Hey guys, we have a big life update.
They are two engineers who dabble in AI on the side and could not believe it when they got picked by Sheeran's team.
Our first reaction was, this has got to be a scam. This has been nothing short of a dream come true for both of us.
The video shows an array of LGBTQ couples and features a runner triumphantly raising a rainbow flag. It's already been viewed more than 100,000 times. There are still a few winners from different countries to be announced. Italy's winning submission is set to premiere on YouTube tomorrow morning. It is all proof that the story a song tells ultimately is in the mind of the listener. We appreciate you listening today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow. A quick note before we go. We are in the middle of our fall fundraising drive and need your help. A generous donor has set a challenge match for us. If we are able to raise $67,000 by December 31st, each donation will be matched one for one. Every gift counts towards our goal. I hope you'll make your gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.